today on the Run to the Top podcast.
There's a lot of things you can do that don't involve just stopping running. And I think that that's one of the concerns, because if runners assume that they're going to be told they have to stop, they're just not going to get it checked out. And the problem is then you're going to deal with a pain that just keeps getting worse and could turn into a serious injury.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Sinead Hockey.
Hey everyone, Sinead here with you for this latest episode of Run to the Top, brought to you by Runners Connect. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoy this podcast and take away some useful information to help you run smarter and faster. If you missed last week's episode featuring Boston Marathon champion Jack Foltz, I would definitely recommend checking it out. Jack is probably best known for his win at the hottest Boston Marathon in history. The 1979 Boston Marathon was nicknamed the Run for the Hoses after spectators lined the course with their garden hoses to cool off runners battling through the 100-degree heat. Over 40% of the field dropped out that year, but through smart racing and determination, Jack managed to come out on top. Over 40% of the field dropped out that year, but Jack ran smart and dug deep to come out on top that day. Jack has continued to impact the sport through various other ventures, including teaching sports psychology at Tufts University and working as a training consultant to the Dana-Farber Marathon Challenge, through which he's raised over $30 million for cancer research. Jack had some truly great insight to share on goal setting, mental game, and bouncing back after a bad race. So if you missed it, be sure to check it out. This week, we're speaking with Dr. David Geyer, orthopedic surgeon, sports medicine specialist, and author of That's Gotta Hurt, a book on the history of injuries in our sport and how sports medicine has evolved to better accommodate runners. David has dedicated his life's work to helping athletes stay healthy and maximize their performance without crossing the line. I can't wait to hear his expertise on biomechanics and the treatments available today that work to reverse damage done by past injuries. So right after a quick break to thank our sponsors, we will jump right into our interview. I want to give a big thanks to Body Health for sponsoring Run to the Top and for giving us Perfect Amino. These 8 essential amino acids are the building blocks of protein that my body needs to train harder and recover faster. You can enter to win a pack of 6 Perfect Amino bottles for free by visiting runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. Thank you so much to Pacific Health Labs for sponsoring Run to the Top and for giving our listeners free samples of their all-natural Excel gels. Learn more on how to get your free samples at the end of this episode and check out Pacific Health Labs at runnersconnect.net/Pacific Health. Hey, David, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How are you doing today so far?
So far, so good. I can't complain. Beautiful day here in Charleston and all good.
Well, I am a little bit envious. David and I were just talking about how we're only a few hours apart, actually, but he's living on the coast in South Carolina, and I'm a huge fan of Charleston, so I'm a little jealous. I need to make a trip down there again soon.
You're in a beautiful part of the world, too, though.
I am. You're right. I certainly can't complain. It's beautiful up here as well, so... But David, you said before we started this interview that you've been in Charleston for quite some time now. You went to school at MUSC, and now you have your own practice in Charleston. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and what really sparked your interest in sports medicine and orthopedic surgery in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I loved playing sports and exercising even when I was younger. Was never really a star athlete by any means. Played lots of sports growing up and loved to run and lift weights. I started lifting weights in high school and running, I guess, toward the end of high school, and just really, really loved it. So as I got into medical school, I decided to be an orthopedic surgeon because you really get to fix people's problems and get them back to what they love to do. And specifically in sports medicine, you're dealing with people that just want to exercise or just want to play sports, all the way from, you know, professional athletes down to just people, you know, adults that just want to do it for fun and for exercise. And there's, it's just really a great feeling to be able to, you know, tell somebody after they suffered an injury or they had surgery, you know, you get to tell them, hey, you can go back to running or you can go back to football or soccer or whatever it is, and see the excitement on their face. There's very little that I can think of, at least in medicine, that's better than that.
Oh, absolutely. And David, you not only have your own practice, but you have your own website, Sports Medicine Simplified. So obviously you work with tons and tons of athletes and different skill levels and different types of athletes. So can you tell us what in your experience has been the most common cause of injury among your clients and runners in general? What would you say that would be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the overall overarching theme with a huge percentage of the injuries we see throughout sports medicine, but especially in runners, would be it's related to some form of overuse. And it could be as much as, you know, as simple as training too much or doing too much without enough time to rest, or it could be pushing through pain, but some form of overuse and causing, you know, these microscopic stresses to the body that in and of themselves are not harmful if you give your body a little time to rest, but that constantly build up over days and weeks and months that lead to things like tendonitis. They lead to things like stress fractures. And so runners are especially susceptible to that because it's the same motions over and over again, hitting the same parts of the body. And so we see that, unfortunately, more than we'd like to.
Oh, definitely. And it's, I feel like runners tend to learn the hard way what their limits are. So do you have any advice for runners when it comes to determining where that line is and trying not to cross it? Do you have any advice for our listeners on that topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of it is individualized in terms of, you know, paying attention to your body and getting used to how hard you can kind of push yourself. I mean, I know this is sort of a general rule of thumb, but where we see it a lot and where I see it in my practice are people that are pushing for some big goal. They're trying to ramp up to train for a marathon, or they've never run before and they're trying to run a 10K, which I'm all for pushing yourself to a new goal, but you've got to work up to that slowly. And so, albeit this is overly simplistic, there's benefit in sort of heeding the 10% rule, meaning you increase your training 10% per week. So if you're only a 10-mile a week runner now and you want to increase that next week, you only increase to 11 miles. And then the week after that, it'd be 12.1. And you do it slowly so that your body can adjust to that increased training and recover from it, rather than going from 10 miles a week to next week, I'm going to run 20 miles a week and then, you know, really ramping it up fast. That's where you see a lot of people start to get a variety of injuries that, to be fair, are completely preventable.
Oh, absolutely. And I feel like we also have a rule at Runners Connect where we don't like to increase two different systems at once. So if people are increasing their mileage, we don't put workouts in on top of that. So is it all just about not exceeding your stress threshold? And as far as stress thresholds go, do they increase as you get fitter? Is that how it works?
Yeah, generally, I would think that they do. That's a great point, too, is in what you're increasing. I used it in mileage, but that's true really with increasing intensity and speed, increasing, you know, if you add in hills or change your terrain, any type of change or increase in what you're doing. The key is to do it slowly and adjust as you go, rather than, you know, just go putting all the eggs in a different basket and really going all out. But I do think as you get stronger, as you get, honestly, you perform better, your body learns to adjust and take on more stress, take on new stress. Doesn't give you the license to go all out and ramp up way more than your body can handle. But I think you do gradually adjust. That's why the 10% rule, even if you stuck to that, as you get into, you know, the higher numbers, the 10% increases are bigger just because your base is bigger. So I think, yeah, you do get to adjust to that more and more.
Absolutely. So we're talking about stresses. Obviously, there are stresses in our lives beyond running. So what are some stresses and lifestyle habits that make a runner more susceptible to injury?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of things that play into it. I think it's not so much a habit, but I think that there's some concerns, especially with running, that you got to be make sure that your body's physically ready to go. So if you're sick, I literally on my website yesterday, I just got an email from somebody that was dealing with running and training for a race around, it was some sort of lung issue that was causing him to have fevers and something like that. And you've got to be very cognizant to your body taking on sickness and recovering from a lot of things. You know, I do orthopedic injuries. I don't really do, you know, colds and viruses and all this kind of medical stuff, but all of that can play a role. Your body, if it's dealing with some of the physical stresses of other illnesses and you're not 100%, in theory, you might set yourself up to bone and joint issues. So, you know, making sure your physical health is okay, making sure you're getting enough sleep, because that's where a lot of your recovery is going to come, I think is really important. And then just overall, if you're going all out, like especially if you have a real physical job, all of that is physical stress that is added on top of what you're doing in your training. So I think you just have to sort of be cognizant of your overall physical demands and make sure you're getting enough time to recover, not just recover from a particular training session.
Oh, definitely. And David, you just touched on so much right there, but one of the things you mentioned was sleep. So while this might be different for everyone, on average, what should runners aim to get at night? Should they be trying to get that standard 8 to 9 hours of sleep each night?
Yeah, I'm always reluctant to tell people, hey, this is what you should do. But I've become fascinated by sleep over the last 6 months, read a number of books, talked to, in fact, I interviewed somebody that's supposedly, he's like a world leader in sports sleep coaching.
Oh,
this is what he does.
Okay.
A lot of Olympic athletes and a lot of English Premier League soccer players, rugby players, things like that.
Okay.
And his thought is, again, it's both based on a lot of what you do. He looks at it in terms of 1 hour, 30 minute increments, because I guess that's your typical like REM cycle. And so that you would want to somehow have your sleep based on those 90 minutes. So, you know, it would either be, you know, 7.5 or 9, or I guess 6, and make sure you fall in those frames. So I think for most people, and I kind of feel this way too, that generally people want to get 8 to 9 hours, not necessarily always possible in our busy lifestyles, but at least try to get within, again, those 90 minute frameworks, try to get 7.5 if you can. If you have a day where you can only get 6, so be it, but then maybe try to get a nap in there somewhere, but don't do that for very long. Try not to have more than 1 or maybe 2 days at the most where it's 6. Try to keep, you know, balanced around the 7.5. If you increase your training, you know, you're really ramping up, then add on more sleep. And there's a number of different, you know, both web or apps for your phone and different fitness monitors now, like one I'm actually wearing right now, that can really tell how much you're sleeping, and you wear it during the day, so it knows how much physical activity you got.
Oh,
and
wow,
it gives you some ideas for sleep. So there's a lot of different ways to do it. I think whatever you're kind of thinking you need for sleep, you probably need more than that. Generally, people don't get enough sleep. So long way of saying there's not an absolute right answer, but generally you need to get more than most of us do.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's definitely, I mean, for our listeners that have busy lives and they're working full-time jobs, it's hard to do it sometimes. But so, David, what's the monitor that you use for sleep? We'll link that below for our listeners if they want to check it out.
Yeah, and I will say right off the bat, I have no financial interest or anything other than I just thought this was interesting. I gave a talk about, I don't know, 8-9 months ago to group that wanted me to talk about technology in sports and technology in sports medicine. So I did all this research on all these different things. And I saw this fitness monitor. It's not even a fitness tracker per se. It's called the Whoop, WHOOP.
Okay.
It's used by Major League Baseball, and a number of the NBA teams use it. It's this little, it looks like a bracelet sort of like a Fitbit, but it's elastic.
Okay.
And you wear it basically all day, 24 hours a day. You put in when you're working out, and it basically tests your intensity and your heart rate and things like that. But the key is that then at night you're wearing it and it knows when you're asleep and when you're not asleep, or you set, you know, start and stop and this kind of thing. But it gives you there's a sleep coach that basically you look at it before you go to bed, and it tells you based on your activity that day, like, I don't know if I have mine in front of me, but I think when I looked at it early this morning, it told me tonight I was going to need 8.5 hours of sleep.
Oh, now, my gosh. Wow.
Well, ignore that, because that's because I didn't sleep well the last couple of nights.
Yeah,
normally, it's about 7.5 to 8.5 hours. And then it basically uses your heart rate variability to know how well you slept. And then it gives you a sleep recovery percentage. And you're either in the red zone, yellow zone, or green zone. And basically, then it gives you a recommendation of how active you can be the next day. If you were in the red 2 or 3 nights in a row, it's not going to want you to do super intense physical activity all day, because in theory, it increases your injury rate. So it's kind of interesting. I'm still playing around with how much I necessarily believe it and all. I think it's really interesting in the sense that, and they published this on their website, basically, and I will say this is true. Once you start using it, I think they said the average Major League Baseball player and NBA player increased their sleep 41 minutes a night wearing it. And I'll say that's true. The more you pay attention to it, Whoop or otherwise, if you start paying attention to your sleep, that naturally is going to make you want to get more sleep, and which is all obviously a good thing. So again, I'm not trying to be an advertising,
That thing,
but it's really cool. I think if people are really struggling to recover, they may look into that.
Absolutely. It sounds like a pretty useful tool. I think we runners tend to put more emphasis on the training and the work itself, and sometimes the recovery kind of falls onto the back burner. So I think remaining conscious of the kind of sleep you're getting and the hours of sleep you're getting can certainly be very beneficial, like you said. So David, while you're certainly knowledgeable when it comes to the lifestyle components of injury prevention, let's talk about biomechanics a little bit. We actually had a barefoot and a minimalist advocate on the show a few weeks ago, Dr. Irene Davis. Not sure. Are you familiar with her?
I know a little bit about it. I know more about barefoot running. I don't know that much about her specifically,
yeah.
But I know this is a really hot topic.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Especially in the running world. So she is obviously a big proponent of minimalism, and she argues that cushioned and motion control shoes can lead to mechanical flaws that can then lead to injury. So I wondered what your opinion on this is. How do shoes play a role in injury?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an important topic for runners in that shoes are really your only real equipment. And it's not like football where you're wearing a helmet and shoulder pads and knee pads and all that. So it does matter a lot. I will tell you off the bat that there is data all over the map on this. There are studies that show that, you know, the more support, the better. There's those that show that can actually be harmful, like she was talking about. I think that there is no consensus. A couple things that I'll kind of point out. One of my really good friends, he and I trained in orthopedic surgery together, and then he went on and did a fellowship in foot and ankle surgery specifically, and sports medicine foot and ankle. So I do sports medicine, but it's all parts of the body. He really only does athletes and foot and ankle things, so knows more about this than anybody. And I was tired of getting questions about barefoot running and not really knowing the ins and outs of what to tell people. Mm-hmm. And his thoughts were, and I'll kind of lean on his advice, that for a lot of people, barefoot running is probably fine. There are certain foot types that it's probably not the best idea. And I think if what he was particularly worried about are people that have very rigid feet, especially very high arches, that then they can't, that the bear, then they need the support, that it's probably fine for sort of a general foot or maybe even a flat foot that's very flexible. But if you had a really rigid high arch, that actually may create other problems, either stress fractures in the foot or maybe problems up at the leg or the knee. So I think the point would be, if you're not sure it's right for you, go see an orthopedic foot and ankle surgeon. Not that you need surgery, that's not what I'm saying, but somebody that can evaluate your foot, not a running store that does these analyses and any of that, but an orthopedic surgeon that can look at your foot, see how flexible it is, and then see what if they think, hey, barefoot running is going to be fine with you for you, then that's fine. My last thing I'll say, though, generally, and I think this is what I usually tell my patients that ask barefoot running or not about what type of shoe is good for them. there was a study that just came out. It had to be in the last couple months, 3-4 months, that showed that the lowest injury rates were people that wore the shoes that were most comfortable for them, not the ones that where they went to a foot store or one of these sporting goods stores and had some sort of analysis and they were put in some special shoe. They just wore what was comfortable to them, and they had the lowest rates, more than the big, fancy, motion controlled shoes or anything else like that. And generally, I think that's true. I don't think there's that many people that have a really abnormal foot type that really need to be spending $200 and $300 on really intricate changes to your to the shoe. Most people can wear sort of a general shoe. So find a good company, good, you know, one that you like a lot. And if you found one that you've done well with, maybe stick with it and just replace it frequently. I know that's a long answer and it doesn't give you a definitive answer on barefoot running. But I think those would be the things. If you're if you want to try barefoot running, that's fine. But maybe just get your foot checked out by a foot and ankle surgeon. And two, if you're going to wear shoes, just stick with stuff a shoe that you really like.
Yeah, no, I think that's the perfect answer. I think obviously it's always important to consult a professional first before you try these things. But I think it's also a good rule of thumb to just keep it simple and go off feel, like you said. Obviously, usually if the shoe feels good, it's probably going to do you well. So.
Yeah. And I think, well, too, no, I think going along with that, you know, too, you know, like I said, I think most people don't have a foot that's really that unusual that you need the fancy gait analysis and all this. And let's be fair, they're trying to sell shoes. Yeah, yeah. I know there's some good ones, but they're trying to sell shoes. But you can kind of do it yourself, quite honestly. You know, run for 4 or 5 months and then look at your shoes, look at the wear pattern and see how if all the wear is on the outside of the sole as opposed to the inside of the sole, you know, figure out if you're an excessive pronator or supinator just based on the wear pattern of the shoe. And then maybe you change based on that. But I think that that plus what's comfortable is probably about all you need to do rather than making an enormous change. And then maybe you might end up creating more problems than you had.
Oh, exactly. I think that's a great tip too, is to pay attention to the wear patterns on your shoes. That tends to tell you a lot about your stride as well. So David, this kind of leads me to another question I had for you. And that was your opinion on orthotics. So obviously orthotics, they've been very popular, especially in the running world for a very long time. But I've seen where recent studies have actually suggested that orthotics can increase injury. So is this true? And if so, why is this?
Yeah, it's potentially true. You have to kind of remember what orthotics are going to do. They're putting support, you know, under one part of your foot, and they can make it to put it wherever you need it. But it's just going to move that stress to a different part of your foot. So that may be fine, and that may be actually a good thing, depending on what you're getting it for. But it also can just move stress to a part of the body and cause an injury there, or all of a sudden you start to have knee pain or pain in the middle of your leg or something like that. So I guess along the same lines of what I was just saying about shoes, I think if you're just doing normal running and you're not having any problems now, I don't know that I would necessarily would start with orthotics. But if you've got, again, this gets back to your type of foot and seeing somebody, if you've got a very flat foot or you've got a very high arch, there are some people that it is a good idea to do that. So, you know, go again, you know, talk to an orthopedic surgeon that specializes in foot and ankle surgery. Podiatrists, some podiatrists are good about this too. Some push orthotics a little too hard. So that's my only concern there with some podiatrists, not all by any means, but just somebody that can say, hey, you don't really need it. Or somebody that says, you know, hey, this may be beneficial. And then, you know, kind of go from there.
Okay, awesome. So like you said, orthotics are right for some people and not for others. So what do runners have to do to figure that out for themselves? Is it just kind of a trial and error process? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, I would want somebody to kind of tell me that I needed to wear them before I even tried. Mm-hmm. I think, again, if you're not having any trouble, I don't know that orthotics necessarily are necessary. Now, if you're battling, you know, this nagging foot pain or maybe a knee pain that could be related to it. Yeah, maybe, you know, go see somebody and see if it's a good idea. But then if you get them, yeah, I think there is an adjustment phase for sure. So maybe you put them in your shoes and then cut back on your training distance and let your foot get used to them and then ramp up your training once you've kind of adjusted.
Okay, very interesting. So we had someone on actually just last week or a couple weeks ago, Jonathan Beverly, and he's a big footwear expert, but he was of the opinion that while orthotics, they're great for some people, a lot of people, it's just more of a matter of strengthening certain weak spots on your body. And so how is that something you would agree with? Do you think it's important for runners to maybe put more emphasis on strengthening maybe say their hips and their lower legs, these weak spots we might have on our bodies?
Yeah, no, I think there's absolutely something to that. I think, you know, and some of these people say, well, you need orthotics because some of the knee pain you're getting while running, it would just be better if you protected certain parts of the foot and moved the stress. And while that in theory makes sense, a lot of that you could get better just by, like you say, strengthening muscles around the hip, stretching maybe the IT band and the lateral tendons of the side of your hip and the knee. That type of thing a lot of times can help prevent injuries on the front end too. So I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. I think if you're dealing, especially with a nagging pain and you're not sure, should I do orthotics? Should I do strengthening? That kind of thing. You know, obviously seeing a doctor can be helpful, but a lot of times too, a physical therapist can work on, evaluating you, seeing if you have certain muscle groups that are tight or certain muscle groups that are weak. They can put you on a treadmill and watch you run and see if you're doing some sort of abnormal gait that they can fix and really kind of get a plan specific for you moving forward.
Okay, absolutely. So David, obviously you're no stranger to injury. You, this is what your entire profession revolves around, but you've written a book called That's Gotta Hurt. And this book chronicles sports injuries throughout history and how they've helped sports medicine evolve. So one story you included was Joan Benoit and her win at the Olympic marathon trials just 17 days after knee surgery. So how did this incident in particular serve as a turning point in medicine? Obviously, this is one that most runners are familiar with.
Yeah, I think this is fascinating. And of all the injuries I talk about in that book, this is one that, albeit most people probably don't remember it, sort of marked a landmark shift in how we treat athletes and really all of us that like to play sports and exercise. You know, before that was in 1984 when she ran in the first ever women's Olympic marathon. Before that time, really the 1970s, early 1980s, you know, if you needed knee surgery, they basically opened up your knee. It would be like an 8-inch or 12-inch incision on the front of your knee to get down to the bones and really get inside the knee. And that's hard to get over. Your knee gets stiff, it gets weak, and that's just it. You know, that's how it was done back in the day. Well, she was having this nagging catching that was really making training next to impossible. And so she had tried all these anti-inflammatories and shots and just wasn't able to train and didn't think she was going to be able to run. So she finally saw a doctor that was affiliated with Nike. She was sponsored by Nike at the time. And he said, look, you know, it's not enough time before the Olympic trials, but we can go in and scope your knee. They didn't have MRIs back in the day, so they didn't know really what was going on with her. So Dr. Stan James scoped her knee, arthroscopic surgery, found the problem. It was a plica. He cut it, and she got back to train and actually won the Olympic marathon trials 17 days after surgery. But what that did was it put arthroscopic surgery on the map. Now people were like, well, wow. I mean, to be fair, that's unheard of even today, being able to run a marathon 17 days after surgery, but it let the world know that, hey, you can have a surgery where through two or three little poke holes, you can do a big operation and take care of a problem and not need that foot-long incision. And now millions of people every year get arthroscopic surgery of the knee and the shoulder and all sorts of body parts. It's probably one of the biggest changes in all of orthopedic surgery, not just sports medicine. And she really put that on the map.
That's remarkable. Her entire story is just so inspiring. We will link a video of her win below here for any listeners interested in checking that out. It's pretty remarkable that she was able to do that just 17 days after knee surgery. And David, you and I have talked about, you said you listened to Dr. Christopher Segler's interview a few weeks ago, and you were just so excited to hear somebody else talking about how unnecessary it is to take time off when injured. It's not always necessary. So, well, Joan Benoit might be a bit of an extreme case. What was your opinion on Dr. Segler's interview? Did you agree completely with what he was saying about the lack of necessity for time off when it comes to recovering from injury?
Well, let me preface it. So I think there's certainly ways you can adjust it. I think as somebody that treats these injuries, and I get runners all the time, and you know, you ask them how long they've been dealing with it, whatever the pain is, they'll tell you, I've been having this for 6 months or a year. And you ask them, like, well, why did it take so long for you to come in? And they will say almost invariably that they didn't want to be told that they have to stop running. Yeah. And so many doctors say you have to stop. So then they just don't come in. And that's where I think some of the problem is that we're very rarely going to just shut you down. I mean, that's why we do sports medicine, is to get people back to what they want to do. But yeah, generally, I think that most of these things, we can make some other changes to get you back to running. Now, I will tell you that off the front end, I'm a big fan of, you know, if it really hurts, just take a day or two off and see if that's just enough to get it better. But you don't have to just stop running altogether. It could be simple. It could be, you know, maybe just for a few days, you switch to a bike or swimming or weights. So you still get exercise, but you give whatever that injured body part is a little time to rest. That's kind of the first thing. And then a lot of it too is just some simple changes that still allow you to run, but move the stress around. And even before we even get to things like orthotics, I mean, it could be working with a physical therapist, as we talked about a minute ago, to strengthen certain parts of the body that have gotten weak, that are putting stress then where it shouldn't be. Or it could be maybe just a short period of time trying taping, or, you know, getting ultrasound and stuff from the physical therapist. There's a lot of things you can do that don't involve just stopping running. And I think that's one of the concerns, because you hit it perfectly. If runners assume that they're going to be told they have to stop, they're just not going to get it checked out. And the problem is, then you're going to deal with a pain that just keeps getting worse and could turn into a serious injury. So that's kind of my view on this whole you've got to stop running type of thing. I don't think that alone is the answer.
Absolutely. It sounds like runners really need to take preemptive action and strengthen these weak spots to help avoid injuries down the line. And a lot of our injuries do seem to be prompted by weaknesses. They're chain reaction injuries. So, David, what are a few common weaknesses for runners?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. That's generally true. I mean, runners tend to be, you know, because the activity is pretty much all the stress is going to certain areas, that's, you know, what you sort of adapts, then it allows other areas to get weak. And this is not everybody, but these are generally some of the things you see. You typically see weak specific muscles around the hip, the external rotators and the abductors out on the side of your hip. And that leads to sometimes a lot of stress around the knee. Mm. A lot of runners have tight hamstrings, which in and of itself may not be a big deal, but if it gets to be particularly tight, that may adjust necessarily how the stress lands and things like that. They tend to be tight on the outside of the knee, tight Achilles tendons a lot of times, that can lead to issues around the back of the foot, the hind foot, and along the Achilles. So there's a lot of different things. That's not true of everybody, but it's true with a lot. Typically, I think a general strengthening and stretching program, this may be the good time to go see if you have a physical therapist friend, or if you wanted to, you know, just see one for a couple of visits, and get sort of a program of simple stretches and strengthening things for you that you just add into your routine for 10 minutes, 2-3 times a week. I think a lot of times that can help you avoid injuries that, like you say, build up and cause a chain reaction down the road.
After the break, David will discuss treatments available today that actually help to reverse damage done by past injuries. This is Sinead Hockey, and you're listening to Run to the Top at Runners Connect. While we runners usually practice good, nutrient-dense diets, most of us lack the amino acids needed to break down and process the proteins we consume. This is bad news for both recovery and muscle growth, not to mention a ton of other vital life processes. That's why Body Health created Perfect Amino, the perfect blend of the 8 essential amino acids to help you build your muscles, expedite recovery, and nab that next personal record. I take Perfect Amino tablets every day and mix the Perfect Amino XP powder in my post-workout smoothies for extended protein absorption. This has helped me work harder and reach new levels in my running, something so important to the Body Health team that if you place in your age group at any public racing event, they'll put you in their winner's circle and send you a free bottle of Perfect Amino. Check it out at runnersconnect.net/winner-circle to learn more. And don't forget to use coupon code RUNNERSCONNECT on your next purchase. That's RUNNERSCONNECT in all caps. Make sure to also visit runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth, where you can enter to win a 6-pack of Perfect Amino worth $230. Again, that's runnersconnect.net/bodyhealth. I wish you the best of luck. When I started using gels to fuel during my long runs and workouts, I'll be honest, I couldn't find one that I didn't hate having to take. All the gels I tried were either too sweet or too thick, making them hard to consume without chasing them down with gulps and gulps of water. They also seemed to be giving me all sorts of GI issues, which obviously made long runs and workouts a lot harder than they needed to be, but even more importantly, I felt like they were impacting my overall health. That is until I discovered Excel Gel by Pacific Health Labs. Unlike most gels, Excel Gel has a thin consistency that makes it easy to take while running, and it's also all natural, completely free of gluten and preservatives you just don't need. It's also the only gel on the market that has the proven 4-to-1 ratio of carbs to protein, as well as a mix of carbohydrates to smooth glucose uptake and extend endurance. Excel Gel helps me get the most out of my long runs and workouts, and I absolutely love it, especially the raspberry cream flavor with caffeine. Right now, Pacific Health is offering all Run to the Top listeners free samples of Excel Gel. All you have to do is send an email to info@pacifichealthlabs.com with the subject line Run to the Top. Then simply request your Excel Gel samples, as well as the address you'd like them mailed to, and then you can try them for yourself for free. Again, that's info@pacifichealthlabs.com. If you want to check out more of Pacific Health's great products, you can do so at runnersconnect.net/Pacific Health. We are back with David. And David, earlier you mentioned a few treatments that are available today that actually help to reverse damage done by injuries. So what are a few of these treatments and what's going on in sports medicine today?
Yeah, I think this could be sort of like we were talking about with the arthroscopic surgery in the early 1980s, sort of a landmark shift. We may be at the point where we're about to make another big, big shift in what we do. Right now in orthopedic surgery, we're generally fixing problems that have occurred and trying to get them back to normal, but we're not usually able to make, you know, an injured knee or whatever it is like it was when you were 12 or 14. Mm. So for instance, if you suffer a meniscus tear, the C-shaped shock absorber in your knee, still a lot of what we're doing is trimming out the torn part of the tear, but now you just don't have as much meniscus as you used to have. Or if the cartilage lining in the knee breaks down, you go in and smooth it out with a shaver. That's still not normal cartilage like it was when you're young. And I think what's coming are these treatments based on your body. And there's different terms for this, regenerative medicine or orthobiologics, things like stem cells that are, you know, substances that come from your body that become injections. They're kind of synthesized in the lab. And what we're hoping in the, you know, as we continue to research these, is that they are going to not just make you feel better, but actually make structures new again. So building new cartilage, you know, building or creating, filling in defects in ligaments and tendons and things like that. There's a lot of debate about these because we don't have a lot of data right now that proves that they work. And these are really expensive and insurance doesn't pay for them. So there's a lot of issues. But if we can basically start to reverse the wear and tear on people's bodies and then we can prove that it works, I think that's going to be a landmark shift, potentially even dramatically cut the number of surgeries that we perform. We just still have a long way to go in figuring out how to use them, when to use them, things like that.
Absolutely. Well, it's all very exciting. I've heard of one treatment in particular that seems to be pretty recent. It's called platelet-rich plasma. So, David, can you explain what this is to us? And
yeah.
So what is this, and what circumstances is it beneficial to have this treatment done?
Yeah, no, I think this is a good example of that. The term people in the general world have heard is PRP, but you're right, it stands for platelet-rich plasma. It's not to get too graphic or anything, but basically what it is, you go to the doctor, they draw a little bit of blood with a syringe just out of one of your veins, like you're giving blood for lab work, just a little bit. That blood, the syringe is put in a centrifuge like we use in chemistry lab. It spins the syringe, and that separates the red blood cells and the white blood cells. And what you're left with is a very small amount of your plasma. And the plasma has platelets, and inside the platelets are all these growth factors. So then you take that plasma and you re-inject it into whatever area hurts. It could be, an area of weakened tendon, like in tennis elbow. It could be into the Achilles tendon if you've got a small area of degenerative tendon for the Achilles tendon. It can be into the knee, for instance, with early knee arthritis. We're still really trying to figure out what conditions it's really helpful and which ones it's not. But we typically use it for things, for problems where the early stuff isn't helping. So maybe physical therapy and anti-inflammatories aren't helping, activity modification, things like that. This is kind of the next step after that, because insurance still doesn't pay for it. So you're asking for people to spend, $250 to $1,000, depending on where you get it and things like that. You're paying that out of pocket. And so that's I don't personally use that as the first line, because again, you're asking people to pay cash. For a lot of things, early arthritis, maybe, like we said, tennis elbow, chronic hamstring issues, maybe some chronic Achilles tendon pain, there it can be certainly something to try before you either stop running or before you have surgery. So I like it in my practice, but I'll say I don't push it on everybody because I think, again, that's a lot to ask people paying cash. But I think that it's exciting in terms of where we're headed with it in the next few years.
Oh, definitely. And obviously, it's different in every case, but how effective is it? How immediate are the effects typically when people get this treatment done?
Yeah, it's not instant relief like people, and I'm not a huge cortisone fan, honestly, but that will give you relief within a couple days. PRP is not that quick because those growth factors have to do their job. They have to bring in cells to help the healing. And so my experience has been that it gradually starts feeling better and better over about 6 weeks. There's a lot of work being done to try to figure out, do you just give one? And I've got patients in my practice, we're trying both, trying to figure out which one is better. But do you just give one injection, or do you do one a week for 3 weeks? We're still trying to figure this out. But in my experience, by about 6 weeks, you have a pretty good sense of, this is about where we are. Did it get you 50% better or 90% better or what? It's not instantaneous like some people hope. Now, if you feel better pretty quickly, that's great, but that's not been my experience.
Okay, very interesting. So getting back to cortisone shots, why aren't you a fan of those? Do they have some drawbacks?
Yeah, I think that there are some good uses for them, but generally I'm not a big fan. And that's largely what I try not to do very often is do cortisone injections into a joint. So into especially the knee, because there's concerns about what the cortisone does to the cartilage in the knee, just like you wouldn't want to do a cortisone injection into a tendon like the patella tendon or the Achilles tendon, because that can weaken the tendon. I don't typically like cortisone. There are the times that I think it would be okay is if like you have bursitis up at the hip, trochanteric bursitis, because it's not getting into the joint. It's potentially helpful there. Okay. But generally, cortisone is just an anti-inflammatory. It's a localized one. It's just getting into that area instead of throughout your body. Most of the time, it's not treating the underlying problem anyway. So a lot of times it's just decreasing pain, but what's actually getting you better is going to physical therapy and strengthening the muscles around it to take stress off that area. But again, then especially in people with younger people with little damage, say in their knee, I actually worry about what that cortisone does to the cartilage. So I try not to use it. Once you get to like bone on bone arthritis, I think then the risk is essentially minimal. So it's fine. But most people that are high level runners have pretty normal joints. So I'm not a huge fan. I think it's one of those that I'm not telling any of your listeners not to get it. I think that if it ever comes up and you go see a doctor, those are the questions to have. What are, you know, do I really need this? What is it really doing? Is it potentially harmful? And then kind of make the decision that's best for you.
Absolutely. It seems like it's a short-term solution to a bigger problem. And I know inflammation plays a vital role in recovery. So that's right. Something I wanted to talk to you about. Is it beneficial for a runner to take anti-inflammatories when they are experiencing inflammation, or should they just kind of let that inflammation run its course?
No, that's a great question. And a couple of things, I'm not a huge anti-inflammatory guy. I'm fine with it for a couple of days. I think if you've been on it for a few weeks and you're still having trouble, then, it's probably time to get it checked out. And I've never thought those medicines are something that you should be taking every day. These people that just take it like scheduled, I don't think they're really meant to do that. Mm-hmm. I think that it really gets, so there's sort of two ways to look at what you just said. The do you want the inflammation? Sometimes you do if it's for the purpose of getting something to heal. So like if you hurt your hamstring, you pull your hamstring in the back of your thigh, there's some thought that if you take anti-inflammatories for more than a few days, you're actually slowing the healing, that you need that inflammation to help the muscle heal. So I think, things like sprained ankles and things, muscle damage, things like that, probably not something you want to be taking lots of anti-inflammatories for. But if it's something where it's the inflammation is the trouble, like IT band syndrome or bursitis up the hip or something like that, taking it for a few days, maybe even a week, probably not a big deal. If you're still not getting better, then I think at that point, you got to get it checked out.
Okay, very interesting. So in terms of facilitating recovery, most athletes are familiar with RICE, rest, ice, compression, yeah, elevation. So how important is this to the recovery process, and how should people implement it for the best results? Are each component of RICE, are they equally important to the other?
I don't know that they're all equally important, but which ones are most important probably depend on what your particular injury is. Of those, though, the rest is going to be the most important generally for whatever your problem is. And again, back to what we were talking about earlier, that doesn't mean you stop running forever. It could be as simple as just modifying what you do. You know, if the running specifically, you sprain your ankle or something, yeah, maybe you can't run for a few days or a week. It doesn't mean you can't do it, swimming or exercise, bike, things like that. But you limit stress on whatever part of the body is hurt to try to get it to heal. I am a huge fan of ice. I know that there is some evidence. Somebody will email me. I have no doubt about this. There's some evidence, people starting to say that ice actually may defeat the purpose, because like you were saying a minute ago, you want the inflammation. But I think it does a good job of helping to decrease swelling, which hurts. And I think if people hate to hurt. So I think generally ice is really good for that. I think the elevation and compression really then get to how much swelling you're having and that kind of thing. Important, especially for lower body stuff. But I think the rest is the one I would really focus on. If you're having some nagging pain or whatever it is, modify what you do for a couple of days. And then try to work back into it and see if you're better. If not, then, maybe that you start to figure out where to go from there to figure out how to get over this.
Okay, very interesting. So getting back to ice, what's your opinion on cryotherapy? I see this all over the place now, and I was wondering what you thought about cryotherapy.
Yeah, I tell you, I haven't used it personally other than just cold shower, which is sort of a very, very minimal version of it, or ice. I haven't done the cryotherapy chambers or anything like that. I think we don't have that much information on it, honestly. I've heard some of the arguments about, you know, some of the benefits of it. I think some of like Floyd Mayweather and a lot of pro athletes are really trying it out. I think the key would be to get as much information as possible. And just, if you're going to try it, make sure you do it safely. You hear some of these stories about how it goes really wrong, and you get frostbite and stuff like that. You know, I think that it's one of those things, look into it and see if it's right for you. I don't think most people need to be spending that kind of money and have a problem that it makes that big of a difference. But maybe for some super intense runner that puts their body through intense demands, there may be some role for it. But again, I think we still have a lot to learn. So my answer to that may change in the coming years. I think it could be great. We may learn that it has tons of benefits. We're just with a lot of this stuff, everything is so anecdotal right now. And until you have, it's one of these problems, my quick little soapbox here, with a lot of these things, and it's back when like the prolotherapy was popular and so many of these different things, you get 20 people to try something and a doctor releases a study saying, I did it on 20 people and they're all doing great. That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. You really need to test people where 20 people got it. But they don't know it. They're blinded to what their treatment was. And then 20 people that were the same, you know, gender, the same ages, the same injury history got something similar, and you randomize people to control group and the test group, and you really see if they got better that way. And so many of these different things, and I'm not saying necessarily cryotherapy, but there's 8 trillion examples of different things that anecdotally people say it works. But then when you do these randomized control trials, it doesn't help at all. And yeah, I think that's one of the problems. You get these people that they've got a financial interest in something and they're trying to promote it. Most of the time with a lot of these things, you do randomized control studies and you don't see any benefit at all. And I don't know if that's going to be true with cryotherapy, but go into all of these things when you want to try some fancy new device or something like that, a little skeptical, you know, until we prove that some of this stuff makes a big difference.
Yeah, I think cryotherapy right now, it seems to have this novelty around it. And it's, for me, I think it would be the last resort personally. It looks absolutely miserable. So it's like negative 200 degrees Fahrenheit. It's that'd be a last resort for me personally, but to each his own, I guess.
I can't see myself ever doing it. I've worked with a lot of pro athletes as the team doctor, and you know, I see them do the whirlpools that the athletic trainer dumps all the coolers of ice in there, and they do that, and they look so miserable. I know they feel better. I have no problem with it, but I just can't imagine the cryotherapy chambers. But having said that, there may be something to it, but it's going to be years before we have real data on it.
Definitely.
So try it if you want. You look into it and you feel like it's safe, but go into all of these new things with a little bit of healthy skepticism too.
Okay, I think that's a great rule of thumb. So, David, my last real question for you is what are some tips runners can take to ensure long-term health and performance? What can we do to ensure long-term success?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the key is we want people being active forever, you know, throughout their lives. And so the key is to encourage people, you know, if it's a sport or in this case, you know, running, to encourage people to do it, but to do it in a way that their bodies hold up so that they can be active later, so that they can play with their kids, so they can run in their 50s and 60s and 70s and just be physically active with daily activities. And so I think there's a few things, obviously a lot of what we just talked about, getting different things checked out. So before it becomes a big problem, maybe you take some simple steps to get over it. Maybe you don't run, and I'm going to get the hate mail for this, but maybe you don't run 7 days a week. You run 5 or 6 days a week, and you do something else that stresses other parts of the body 1 or 2 days a week. You know, maybe you train intently or intensely for 9 months, and then you back off for 2 or 3 months, still run a little bit, but not the same intensity or distance. And you focus on yoga and other flexibility, or you focus on weights and build up some other body parts, things like that, to just give your body time to rest and recover, and then find ways to keep it fun. I think I hear a lot and see a lot where people just burn out and stop. And that's not good, because maybe they pick some other physical fitness, some other exercise up, but a lot of them don't. And that's not good, because again, the benefits of health and the benefits of running physically on our health and emotionally and mentally are so much that we don't want people burning out. So find ways. Maybe you run with friends some days a week. Maybe you vary up races and just do some that are fun and not just make it super intense training for years and years and years. Because the last thing you want is to burn out at 30 or 35 and you start getting overweight and you start having medical issues, heart issues, blood pressure issues, things like that. So make it fun. Keep your body healthy. Get it checked out if you're having trouble, so that you can do it for the rest of your life.
Absolutely. Like you said, it's hard sometimes not to fall into the trap of looking at running as a means to an end, purely looking at the outcome instead of enjoying the process. And it's definitely a good rule of thumb to enjoy the process, certainly for longevity in the sport, like you said. So, David, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your incredible knowledge with us. I've learned so much during this interview, and I'm sure our listeners have as well. So thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us today.
Oh, I really appreciate it. Yeah, this was a lot of fun. And I love talking to people that are active. That's what we want. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to hopefully give some ideas for that people can take so that they can do it longer and better. I hope this was helpful. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Geyer's book comes packed with a history of how sports injuries have truly influenced sports medicine today, including Joan Benoit's legendary comeback from a severe knee injury just a few days before the Olympic trials. If you're not familiar with Joan Benoit's story, she not only won the 1984 Olympic Trials Marathon just 17 days after knee surgery, but she also went on to take the gold at the Olympic Games that year with a finishing time of 2:24.52. Check out the video below for a recap of Joan's inspiring performance, and take a look at David's book and website through the links below to learn more on how to set yourself up for long-term health and performance. I hope you enjoyed today's interview and took away some useful information. So next week, we'll be speaking with one of the most renowned sports nutritionists in the world, Dr. Louise Burke. Louise is head of discipline in sports nutrition for the Australian Institute of Sport, and she's served as team dietitian for the Australian Olympic team for the past 6 Olympic Games. She's the author of the books Practical Sports Nutrition and Clinical Sports Nutrition, as well as a leading expert on fat adaptation and endurance sports. We'll cover everything from nutrition periodization to the facts behind the popular low-carb, high-fat diet. So be sure to check that out next week. And until then, I hope you have a fantastic run today.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from RunnersConnect.net.